This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Noah Heyman is a dating and relationship coach through his site, datecoach.com, and his Instagram, datecoach.com. He helps people find love through where to look in person, how to approach people, what apps to use, their profiles, photos, messages, conversation technique, body confidence and intimacy. That's everything, really. Some of his clients' most common challenges besides finding dates related to long-distance relationships, jealousy, whether that be in relationships that are monogamous or open or polyamorous, being on the autism spectrum, being fat or living fat people, and frustrations with sex or kink. Drawing in a deep background in the data of what works in online dating, as well as psychology, communication, and real-world experience, Noah helps his clients improve self-awareness, attract aligned partners, and develop deeper intimacy in their romantic lives. His work bridges mindful personal development with the often chaotic realities of modern dating, making him a powerful and thoughtful voice in the intimacy space. And he's been kind enough to join us today. So thank you very, very much. I really appreciate you giving us some of your time. It is such an important topic. And sometimes when people think, oh, dating relationships, sometimes it can seem quite, I don't know. It doesn't seem like one of life's most important things, but being with the right person, spending time with the right person or people, what could be more important than that, really? But I did want to take you back a little bit, if that's okay, to start off with, and just understand what your own teenage and formative years were like. Is it possible to draw a link between the person you were then and the person you are today?
Absolutely. So, Andrew, I really appreciate that introduction. That was very warm. For me, it's a very direct link, right? I was around 12 when I noticed, wait, I don't like the skinny girls. I like the chubby boys. And that's a really weird thing, right? It was the 90s, so gay was bad. Fat is still bad today. And I wasn't particularly flamboyant. So I assumed I was straight and that's what being straight was. You pretend to like the girls. And it was sometime in high school, I was like, oh, shoot, I think I might be alone on this one. And I still had too much shame to do anything about it. And so going into college, the things I wanted to study that I spend my life doing now, psychology, sexuality, these kind of things, I couldn't study them because that's what gay guys study. And I didn't want to out myself. And I continued, you know, dating women and thinking I would just live a closeted life. And fortunately, I realized that was just too sad. And I eventually came out, after college. But by that time, I had already chosen this other career and I was going into the Foreign Service and became a diplomat for more than a decade. But during that time, all the things I was doing with my, like, all my reading and was about coaching and about attachment theory and gender and asexuality and anatomy and sex and reading all of the data on what works in dating profiles and photos and messages and on a date and conversation techniques. This was all I was reading, and people found that pretty weird. But they also started to appreciate it because I started using it as a hobby to help my friends because I couldn't stand seeing them lonely, right? I wanted them to be in love. And eventually I started to feel closeted again, right? That I was doing the wrong thing with my life. And it took me more and more time than I wish it had to finally throw away my day job and do this full time. And I'm very happy that I did now.
And I think a lot of people are very happy you did as well. So when you were growing up and you were not open about your sexuality and your desires, etc., how was gay life and gay men in particular, how were they portrayed in the media at the time?
Oh, I mean, the 90s, the joke was, that's gay, right? That the joke. It's so cringe to watch all of, you know, my favorite stand-up comics from the time and realize, like, wait, they're just punching down at me, right? I was laughing at this. I remember, you know, even as a freshman in high school, I said, I went to a different high school than for middle school, and I said about somebody like, oh, that's gay, or he's gay. I don't even remember. There were a couple of girls. They were like, are you homophobic? And I'm like, no. And later I was like, yes. But how could I not be in that environment? And you know, I'm happy I got out of it. You know, this was a very lonely thing, even being in New York City with theater director parents. And my little brother came out even before I did, right? I had every advantage, right? I feel like such a schmuck that, you know, all of my clients are like, oh, you came out at 23. I'm coming out at 40 or something. Yeah, but you're growing up in Alabama in a Pentecostal family and stuff. Like, I don't know. I think you went through an even harder experience than me. So I'm happy I made it. But like, oh, what unnecessary, you know, strife at the time.
Mm. It's very interesting that you talk, and I sort of mentioned in the introduction, you talk and understand a lot about the data behind dating. And it's something that fascinates me, that the data in general. Just, I was always a data geek as a sort of, you know, kid, and then growing up and getting in my job, I could always sort of see patterns in the data, just look at it and see, oh, that looks right, that's weird. And what are the things that you can uncover with the data about dating? And the reason I ask that, I guess, is because I look at sort of friends' dating profiles, and they ask me, it's probably the same thing. Why are we getting dates? You look at some of their pictures and some of their alleged interests, and then you think, would you want to date yourself? If you look at it that way, would you actually want to date this person? And I think some of the pictures are, very, very odd. I don't think people necessarily understand how to use dating apps and digital technology to get dates.
Yeah. You're right. So I'm using science in every aspect of coaching that I can, right? There's science when it comes to conversation. There's science when it comes to body confidence or sex. Mm-hmm. But the area where the data makes it clearest is the online stuff, because it's the numbers are so crunchable there. Yeah. We can look at who's getting clicked on, who's getting a message, who's getting a response to their message. The data scientists can even extrapolate who's getting into relationships, because if people are messaging each other and then change their status or delist relatively simultaneously, they'll assign a high probability of a relationship, right? These kind of things. And so the three areas that the data is clearest is what works in photos in an app, what works in what you write about yourself, your narrative, and what works in an opening message. Those are the kind of clearest things in the data. And it's not just one thing, it's many, many things, right? And there's all these wonderful charts and stuff that you can see. So people write their PhDs on this stuff, that, you know, this chart of like the time of day of the photo, or the depth of field of the photo, or the facial expressions in the photo, right? And you can say, oh, okay, well, the golden hour before sunset is the best, and dawn hour is like so close as to be, you know, the difference is negligible. The depth of field is at 2.8. Yeah, that's kind of the best. And lower, that's not really a problem. But high, by the way, depth of field is just how fuzzy the background is. And I loved solving all of those things. And I love sharing that with my clients. Most of my clients end up trying online dating and, you know, using that data to their advantage. Now, sometimes if the data says that the best expression in a photo, Andrew, would you like to guess what's the best expression in a photo? Let's say for a guy, what would you guess?
A smile?
That's what I thought. Smile is like close second. It's a laugh.
Okay. Right?
Just that difference. So when I'm taking my clients' photos, or I'm having their friend take their photos, I'm getting them to like, no, the air has to move. I want to hear you. I need that, right? And it's not the sexiest expression, but it's the warmest, right? Right? And because we're not going This is dating. This is not just a hookup. All right. I mean, if it is, that's a different thing. And there's different data for that. But my clients like to take advantage of it. Now, some of my clients might say, well, even though the data says that, I'd prefer to do this. That's fine. You have to be confident with what you're doing. Make it your decision. Feel authentic throughout. You know, if you'd never wear that kind of shirt, don't wear it in your photo. And yet most of the time we can get much closer, and it takes away a few issues. One is, a lot of people complain that dating apps suck. Yeah, they suck because we're doing it badly, right? That we're getting, women never respond to me. They never respond to that profile, right? They might respond to a profile that is more attractive and authentic to you. And because it's working for a lot of people, you know, the latest data is that in the United States, 60% of relationships started on an app. Okay. Everyone says, no, the apps are over. And the chart, it's going up rapidly. Right. And all the other ways that people meet, which I still help my clients do if they want, right? There's, you know, speed dating or going to a bar or asking friends to set you up or just approaching someone at the supermarket. Yes, they're all possible. And for some clients, they can work really well. If I have a particularly, you know, extroverted client, or they're particularly bad at typing, they're, you know, extremely dyslexic and they can't stand being online, sure, we can meet a person too. But this is continuing in a very upward way. So if we're not taking advantage of it and doing it the best we can, we're giving up a big opportunity to find our partner if that's what we're looking for.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the ways that many of us perhaps met our partners historically, so I met my partner at work, so I met my wife at work.
Yeah.
And I think there is there's certainly been a shift in the appropriateness of workplace relationships, the appropriateness of meeting somebody in public. I think people perhaps are more nervous about saying, doing the wrong things, might perceive the wrong things. Mm-hmm. Ask somebody, you can ask somebody out of work once, if they say no, that's it. You can't work in the department, you break up, all these different things happen.
Right.
So you think the apps give you more clarity, I guess, around what could work and what couldn't work? And I guess there's two bits of people, I guess, in my head. There's one that's perhaps grown up with smartphones, apps. It's part of their, like my daughter's 18, my son's 15. They've grown up with it. That's what they've always known. Mm-hmm. People of my age, if I break up with my wife now, heaven forbid, and I have to go back on the dating market, it just, the idea terrifies me, I guess. Just thinking about how do I get into the whole apps and understanding, et cetera? So how do you... And I guess the first question is there a difference between people that are digital natives, that's the right word, and people that are perhaps, oh my goodness, I met my wife at work or in a bar or whatever, or a nightclub, what do I do now?
Yeah, I think, you know, the younger generation that uses smartphones all the time since birth or whatever, only has a very slight advantage here, because it's not really that, you know, comfort clicking and comfort texting and stuff. Yes, that stuff helps a little bit. But the difference between, you know, using an iPad to, you know, watch YouTube videos or send TikToks or something, and dating is very big, right? And the parts that are most challenging are, you know, how do I write about myself? How do I show myself in photos? How do I chat with somebody to get to a date? How do I be, you know, authentic or sufficiently forward without being a creep and stuff. This is, nobody was practicing this as a kid, right? That's not part of it. So I think often my older clients are using it a little as a crutch or an excuse, right? That like, well, it's just, I'm not there. Yeah. The younger people are not comfortable on the dating apps either, right? They really aren't. And, you know, I live in New York City, and you see a real, you know, swell of enthusiasm for any other way to meet, even for young people, right? 1,000-person board game picnic, right? Yeah. Where we can do that, or, you know, because nobody wants to be on the apps. And yet it's not that, yes, it's a little bit, we're working in person less, and the Me Too movement makes people feel a little bit more nervous. And, yes, these things are all real, but it's more that the apps provide a really great way to meet people that did not exist 40 years ago or whatever, right? right? And I would see it more in those very positive terms. It's very exciting. I met my partner on an app, and even like if we could have met at a bar, yeah, great. But I don't think I would have met him, right? Like it's hard, and I'm not even that introverted a guy. I wouldn't say it's so generational. But you know, for anybody, it's a big reason I'm here. People, you know, what app should I be on in the first place? And how do I do this? Some of the apps, it's amazing to watch how they're all converging to the same thing. Hinge and Bumble were such different apps some years ago, and now they're virtually the same, right? Yeah. The prompts sound the same. The number of prompts, the ways you can respond to the prompts, the number of photos required, the ways it's weird. Those are not the same company. What are they doing? How is everything converging?
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
But they're actually more usable than a lot of the old things. And that's responding to, they have their own data scientists who are like kind of helping try to tee it up for people, but it's still by no means intuitive. I think help's a great thing. A big reason also was that when I looked back to myself, I'm 41, when I was dating at 25, my goodness, I wish I had saved my profile. It was so bad, right? My photos were ridiculous, right? Like just not, they don't look like me. They don't show me well. The way I described myself was like very off-putting. And I was trying. I was a smart kid. I was trying. And I just was getting it wrong. And that's a lot of my clients. It's just like, it's hard.
Are there fundamental differences between how men looking for women, women looking for men, and then men looking for men, women looking for women, how they differ in terms of how the profile should read, how they should look? Obviously some of the words are key, but are there more similarities or differences?
Absolutely. Well, I will start by saying, even though I live in a pretty lesbian neighborhood and have, you know, a bunch of lesbian friends, lesbians are a complete enigma to me. And I wish I could say I coach everyone.
Yeah.
Except lesbians. That's kind of been my experience. So I feel almost, you know, I have clients of every gender and every in between doing all kinds of crazy stuff, but I've very rare for me to have a lesbian approach me. And that makes sense to me, that a woman looking for a woman is not asking a man for help.
Yeah.
But as for everybody else, yes, the data is clear. It's quite different, right? Yeah. That women tend to write and read more. Right. So if you're writing for a female audience, you're going to want to write more to her and more about yourself as well. Mm-hmm. Men tend to write and read less. Right. And that's fine. But, you know, this is not, there are certainly men who write and read a ton and women who write and read very little. Right. There's tons of overlap here, but in a general sense. Right. And we can even say, you know, it's more important rather than the gender of your audience. If you're thinking, I'm going to message this person, to mirror them, what they've presented to you in their profile. Mm-hmm. So if they wrote, for example, if I'm writing to a gay man, an opening message, and he writes almost nothing, I still have to write 10 words according to the data to hit the sweet spot. And if he writes 1,000 words, I shouldn't write more than 20. That 10 to 20 is still the sweet spot, right? Whereas women, no, 20 is more like a minimum number for an average woman, right? So there are constant differences. Then there are differences besides how we do our profiles and our messages. how we go on a date, right? It's very normal for gay men to have sex on their first date, right? Because there's no or much less concerns about physical safety, about shame, like slut shaming, this kind of stuff. There's much less of that kind of baggage. And also men are, you know, maybe more just like feasting with their eyes. And they're like, yep, you look good. Do I look good? Okay, shall we? Right. Whereas women on average don't want that, right? They want to feel, it's not how cute you are. That's only a little bit. How do you look at me? How do you make me feel, right? Sexuality is a little more, you know, focused on, you know, back at me. I don't want to say narcissistic, but in that direction. And that takes a little bit more time to build, only on average. So there are, you know, a lot of men are not going on, gay men are not going on a second date without having sex on the first date. A lot of women are waiting to have sex until they're comfortable and excited. And a lot of straight men are waiting until the woman is ready and wish it would be sooner, right? These are very common dynamics.
Yeah. It's very funny. Just a little personal story, if that's okay. So I used to live in a small town in the middle of England, in a place called the Cotswolds. A very small town. I didn't meet anybody that was Asian until I was about 16. There wasn't any black children or children of color at my school at all.
Sure.
And I moved to London when I was 18. And got a job at Harrods in the sort of menswear department. And this is going to sound ridiculous, people listening. I knowingly met the first gay person I ever met at 18 in the menswear department. And there were lots of people there. It was like a gay pickup joint in the way. Lots of people come in and go out and you think, oh, that's weird.
Sure.
And to me, this naive sort of 18-year-old kid coming from the middle of nowhere. And it was amazing. This guy there called Paul, and he was like, coming every sort of Monday morning and sort of regale me with the tales of the people he sort of met and met him in the park and come up to his house and done this and that. And it was always very much about, well, the sex comes first, then we'll figure out if there's a relationship there. And yes, he did have relationships and lots of other people in the department. But it was almost like, yeah, just peeping through the keyhole and think, oh my gosh, it's so different. And there's so much less. There seemed to be so much less of a hang-up. It was just about, gosh, can I ask them? Should I ask them? Should I try and kiss them? Should I try and do this? It was just,
right. Yeah,
much, much more open and things. And it was, and I'm not sure what to tell you that. It was just really interesting how this, from knowing nothing at all, to suddenly, as you say, much, much more around the, well, sex is okay. We have sex. And then is the relationship worth pursuing now, really?
And I find that really, it's very common. You know, the complaint that's more common in my gay clients is, how do I move it to something other than sex, right?
Yes.
There's right, like I want an actual relationship, an actual partner, and I've had a tremendous amount of sex, but what how do I even turn that? There's a lot of kind of cruisy hookup type apps, and I don't mean, you know, Grindr or something. Yes, you can hook up on Grindr, you can also meet your husband on Grindr. I mean more like Sniffies or something, which I'm not sure you've heard of, but this is a very cruisy kind of thing, very, you know, just sex. And can you have sex with someone and then say, that was fun, would you like to get a coffee, right? You can throw in the date afterwards, right? You can do that, but you know, it can be hard. Gays have a superpower, at least the out gays, because they've come out, right? They've already kind of violated a societal taboo, right? Maybe it's not a taboo in Brooklyn in 2025, but surely in some part of a person's life, you know, coming out as gay was difficult. That once you do that, it allows you in many cases to then do what you want, right? Go for whom you want, right? If you will see that in gay relationships, you know, interracial relationships are more common. Relationships that are, there's a bigger age gap or socioeconomic or educational gap. These kind of things are more common because it's like, well, you know, well, I wouldn't, you know, a straight person, I just can't. I'm going to stay in my bubble, right? It's like, I'm outside. There's no bubble. I can do whatever I want. And I feel so grateful for that, right? I've only ever liked fat men. That's the only thing I've ever been attracted to, right? And I've encountered a number of clients who are straight, and only like that women or only like that men. And it's very hard for them to actually date and to not feel ashamed of their partner and stuff, which is really gross and unpleasant for the people they're dating to feel, to feel hidden instead of to feel like they're somebody's proud of them and those kind of things. And on the other hand, you know, the my fat straight clients who are, you know, facing this difficulty of like, I don't want to be the secret girlfriend and stuff. So yeah, gays have a superpower. I wish all my friends, may you have a straight teenage child and a gay adult child, right? Because, you know, being a teenage gay, maybe not anymore, but for me was hard. But being a gay adult, woof, man, it's easy. It's tough to be straight. I feel for you. I'm sorry, Andrew.
it's funny, as you were saying that, though, because I think gay men in particular, again, I don't know about lesbians, it feels like a whole different different ball game.
Yep.
Forgive the pun. I think a lot of gay people, they almost subcategorize. So you have twinks and bears and all these different sort of words. Whereas for straight men, we don't really. We're just sort of straight men, and we might like say like a larger lady or like a super skinny lady or a short lady or whatever. But we don't have that sort of category that I like bears or I'm a twink or I like or whatever or I'm always a bottom or a top. Or we don't have that. We're just straight men. It's quite dull.
But they do have them. They just don't share it with their blokes, right? They just don't talk about it that much because they don't want to be teased. They don't even want to think about it themselves, right? I have lots of clients who want something, but they don't know how to say it, right? Like a man who wants a more sexually dominant wife, is he really going to tell his buddies? Not necessarily. If he wants, you know, a wife who degrades him sexually, right? Is he going to share that? Is he going to share that he likes, you know, fatness or grumble like, I wish you were skinnier, even though he's being disingenuous, right? Mm. Or on the other hand, a guy who's really, you know, a feminist and kind of modern thinker and stuff, but actually he's attracted to like the trad wife thing, right? He wants a housekeeping, you know, child raising wife who defers to his authority. That kind of thing is deeply embarrassing and feels shameful. But there are women who want that as well. How can he even explore that if he's a feminist, right? This stuff is really hard, and it's generally harder for straights.
Mm. Since you said about men that perhaps are going to be more submissive to their partners, I spoke to a really wonderful dominatrix a few months ago in Poland. She's fabulous, and she was saying almost all the clients that come to her because they're too ashamed to talk about this with their wife or partner. They have a high powered job and whatever, and they just want. And she said it's not often about, it's never about sex. It's just about being submissive and submitting for an hour, either being degraded or whatever the things are. But they're almost too ashamed to ask their partner for it. Yep. And if you can't ask the person you've had, you know, three children with, been together for 20 years, if you can't talk to them about it, it's really a part of your life that you're putting on hold, really. And we've had instances in the UK recently. There's a famous soccer player. Hmm. And his girlfriend, that he's been with since he was 15, happens to be probably fairly typical, but a larger woman. They're both white, and she happens to be, I don't know, in the UK, a size 16, 18. So not big, but just bigger than average.
No, just curvy, yeah.
Yeah, and the media, without saying, she's too fat for you, why are you with her? That's pretty much what they've led with, really. It's almost like this famous footballer that earns $400,000 a week, surely he could find somebody slimmer and more attractive, which is extraordinary. And that's the sort of level that the media is still at in the UK. And I'm sure not much difference in the US.
Sure. I mean, you could look at French media, how much have they talked about Emmanuel Macron's wife, you know, as president of France, being whatever she is, 19 years older than him or something. It's wild. And you say, if you can't share it with your spouse, who can you share it with? That is extremely common. For a lot of people, that would be the last person because it's the highest risk. What if she loses respect for me? What if she doesn't like that, right? Mm-hmm. This is why I encourage my clients to be themselves and authentic and candid from the start, right? From the first message, from the first date, right? Because it doesn't get easier on date five or year five, right? I had a friend who recently got married, and his partner does not know his central kink. He's never brought it up because of fear of judgment, right? Makes me very sad, right? I had a nice, I was coaching all night as I always do, and at a client last night who he went and flew and met somebody on a vacation, right? Mm-hmm. And the guy lived in another country. And so my client was American, the other guy had less money. And so my client paid for everything. And he had a great time and it was all a lot of fun. But now he's worried about, okay, now the guy might fly to the United States and come see me. And I wish I had brought up money earlier. I'm like, well, bring it up now, right? However, you know, it's never too late. This, you know, the best time is now. Yes, the better time was even before, but whatever it is, let's do it now, right? And it doesn't ultimately have to be balanced, right? It just, equal. It just has to be balanced, right? If he has absolutely no money and you love his company, then you might have to pay for everything, but you can talk about it. You can say, I don't want to, hey, I don't want to feel like a sucker. And I don't want you to feel like you can't afford to see me and stuff. How do we balance this? Is it 2/3, 1/3? Where are we at? Have the discussion, because eventually you get into a relationship. It's not like money dynamics go away just because you're in a relationship, right? Yeah. Whatever it is that client, had kind of that breakthrough of asking for what he wanted. Another thing was asking to vet the person a little bit before they even meet. It's another thing that he wanted. So he flew to this other country to meet this guy. They had never even done a video call, just exchanged some messages. Wow. Okay. And I was like, well, ooh, did it cross your mind? He's like, yeah. It crossed my mind, especially when you told me to do it last session. And I thought about it and I just couldn't bring myself because I just didn't want to impose. What if it drove him away? What if he didn't like me? And he was planning to go see another guy. It was an hour and a half, 2 hour drive to go meet this guy and that he was messaging online. That again, I was like, oh, okay. Besides the messages, have you done a video call? No. Do you think you should? Yes, I think I should. It would really suck if I drove 2 hours and the guy was a no-show and I could have vetted him a little bit more. But I just don't want to ask. And we started delving, I am not a therapist, but we started delving a little bit into like, where is this coming from that we can't ask for what we want and we can't be candid? It's like, probably growing up as a, chubby gay kid in an Irish Catholic family. And, well, there's all of this stuff. And to try to overcome it, the most common technique is to think about what did this defense mechanism or whatever you want to call it, what did it achieve for me? How did it protect me? How did it get me things I wanted in my relationship with my siblings or my parents? Maybe more attention or more respect or fewer questions about who I was. And now how is it causing me more harm than good? And can I let it go? Right. Sorry, a little rambling, but I get excited about my clients all the time, and it's hard to answer.
I did want to ask you about when to and how to be more vulnerable, but I'm going to come on to that in a second. So, what I wanted to ask then was that I think a lot of people that maybe it's an assumption more than a fact, but do you think people that perhaps had previous relationship trauma, difficulties, rejection, are more likely to self-sabotage going forward? Because you talked about, well, how is this defense mechanism helping? I wasn't sure whether it's defense against being emotionally vulnerable or self-sabotaging almost in that, well, I knew I wasn't worthy anyway. My last partner told me that wasn't worthy, so therefore this just proves it. But they're doing something themselves to almost cause it to happen. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, there's a trauma from most past failed relationships, right? Usually when a relationship fails, there's something there. There's also a trauma from a lack of relationships, right?
Yeah.
A client who's, you know, in their 40s and hasn't had a relationship, which is a lot of people, a really staggering number of people who wish they'd had a relationship and never had one. That is its own form of trauma, and it's you know, it's its own obstacles. But yeah, I think it often comes from past relationships, and you know, we try to learn something from every relationship without kind of either overcorrecting or repeating the mistake or something, right? But yeah, I think that's a huge source of the trauma. But it's you know, our relationships with a friend who disappeared on us, or you know, a sibling or a parent who bullied us or something, can also really affect how we'd interact in a romantic relationship. Absolutely. For sure. Yeah.
Hmm. Just on, you mentioned about being open or vulnerable very early on in a dating dynamic, and I just wanted to, I don't know, question or challenge that a little bit. Not Please. Saying it's wrong, I'm just curious. So, you know, there's obviously a difference between a fetish and a kink. And to my understanding, a fetish is something that you need to get off, and a kink is something you enjoy maybe once in a while or maybe regularly. So if you're on that sort of first interaction or date or whatever, and you occasionally enjoy being tied up, or if you're a straight guy, you might, you know, enjoy being pegged once in a while or whatever, is... When do you raise those topics? Because they're not necessarily a deal breaker. Mm-hmm. So you don't necessarily want to scare somebody off, but you want to get out of there that, hey, these are some things I enjoy. So without scaring somebody else, saying, hi, I'm Andrew. I really enjoy being pegged or being tied up. So, right. Sorry, is that something at the door? when do you throw those things out there?
Yeah. It's going to depend on the context, right? Gays can do it a little sooner than straights. So we've already talked about that, just kind of in all regards sexually, right? And you know, it's also societal, right? I've lived in, you know, countries like, you know, Pakistan is a much more conservative society than the United States. You know, so you know, maybe age can play in. So there's a lot of those things. Whenever you're approaching something a little bit difficult, I encourage my clients to build up to it, right? Whether it's sharing something that's very vulnerable or very forward, or physically touching the person, or whatever you're delving into, just try to come up with as many intermediate steps as you can, right? So as you're pressing into it, whatever the topic is, there's a few techniques. One is trying to get their buy-in. So this can look like, I want to bring something up, but it's going to be too forward for you. Yeah, I don't want to do that, right? And then, no, please tell me, okay? So there's that. Then as you cautiously do it, some people call it boiling the frog, right? If you only raise the temperature slightly, then the frog won't jump out of the pot. Some people talk about like the stoplight conversation techniques, that you don't want to jam yourself into a red light where they're like, ooh, I don't want to talk about that.
Yeah.
And neither do you want to sit back in green lights and, oh, so what are you up to this weekend? Oh, okay. What do you do with your summers? What, you're just making no progress, right? Like, so you hit the yellow lights, right? Try to push those topics. And as you delve into it, you know, you're reading what that person is giving back to you. You know, there are some, you know, just straight women who are like, yeah, I would totally talk about all kinds of kinks on the first date. And there are some who are like, I've never actually talked about kinks in my entire life. So it's gonna depend, right? By the way, the difference between kink and fetish, whatever the dictionary says, is different for different people. So it's great to define it, right? In most cases, kink is a positive term and fetish is a negative term, right? For the same thing, even without like defining it further, right? So, you know, if somebody finds degrading language, a negative thing, they might say, that's a fetish. And somebody else might say, that's a kink, right? And it's just a difference. For some people, these kind of trying to yellow light and trying to make this little bit by bit progress, even that is really hard. And some of my clients look for like a pictographic method to share what they're into rather than having the conversation at all. This is a really cool thing. So there's things like BDSMtest.org, right? Mm-hmm. Where you answer all of these questions and then it gives you these percentages, right? You're 60%, right? 60% submissive. You're 40% degradee. You're 80% like to tie somebody up, whatever. Mm-hmm. And you can just share this pictographically and it kind of normalizes. And they do it too, hopefully, right? It would be nice if it's an exchange. And it doesn't even get into specific acts, just kind of modalities of sex. Mm-hmm. What might we enjoy? So there's that kind of tool. There's a much more specific thing like kinksheet.com where you're going through specific acts and you're clicking on each, you know, I'd love to do it or I'd like to do it or if you want it or I don't want to do it. You can share it that way. There's, if you're even shyer, there's something like mojoupgrade.com where you, for specific acts, like I put hot wax on her, she calls me names, whatever. Mm-hmm. You say, absolutely not. Or if they want to, or I'd like to try, right? And then it gives you a list at the end and anything that one person didn't want to try just doesn't appear on the list so that you don't have to be too shy of like, ooh, I was going to say that I was into piss play and now she doesn't like that. Now she judges me as like some gross freak, right? So it just doesn't show up. And the things that you both want to try show up higher. And it's like, man, we've been together 3 years. We both want to try this. Why didn't we? We could have had so much fun. Yeah. Anyway, so there's a lot of techniques. And I wish I could give you like a do it on date two. But it's a kind of a gradual process.
And for people that might be listening that currently aren't dating, not about as good or bad news, but don't think this goes away when you've been dating somebody for 20 years,
right?
Because you might be with the same person for, it could be, depending on your relationship, 1 year, 20 years, 50 years, and never talked about these things. You do the things that you do when you first started dating 20 years ago. And sex has a sort of rhythm to it or almost a mental checklist. And that's it. You never think, I did read about that boundaries thing I saw on that film or listened to on that podcast. That's really interesting. But yeah, when you've not talked about it for 20 years, suddenly bringing it up is like, right now, what do I say? I like the way you talked about almost seeking permission in a way to talk. And almost rather than sort of just blurting something out, sort of saying that, really good to sort of talk to you maybe over dinner tomorrow night just about some of the things that I'm thinking about. You know, not with any expectation or judgment, but just let's just talk about them. Because nobody wants to be ridiculed or to be horrified, do you? You want to be able to say something and have the other person listen and say, yeah, okay. But I really like the idea of the, was it mojoupgrade.com? And those things you can say, those lists. I think that's a really great idea.
It is a cool. There's so many tools, right? People don't like the internet and don't like the apps and stuff, but there's so many cool tools and things that just couldn't be done before. As you're coming up with, you were saying with a partner, it doesn't necessarily become easy just 20 years in, right? And something could change. Somebody could develop like, oh man, I thought I was just dominant. I'm actually a switch. I like to dominate and to submit, right? And how do I introduce that to a partner that I've only done this one thing with, right? Mm-hmm. It's if you've built a base of candor, right? You can continue to share more. And also the nice thing about sharing and being a little vulnerable yourself, it encourages the other person to be vulnerable. It creates this positive feedback loop. But I love with my clients, sometimes date coaching turns into a little bit of sex coaching and they'll come up with some obstacle, right? Mm-hmm. In relationship coaching, it even becomes sex coaching. So there's, my partner loves to degrade people verbally and to be degraded verbally. And I can't do either. What do we do? Right. And sometimes we can come, well, does it need to come from you? Right. Could you put on that language in the background in porn? Or could you put a mirror next to you while you're having sex? And she says this stuff about herself, like, yeah, get her, that slut, and says it about herself. And so she is degrading herself in essence, right? Does that work? Yeah, it can work. right? Or, you know, an open relationship where you're trying to set up rules about this relationship. Even monogamous relationships should have rules, right? Is porn cheating? Is going to lunch with a woman and not touching her, is that cheating, right? You should talk through all of these things. But let's say, okay, you're open. Okay, my wife, she wants to sleep with other men. I don't really have any problem with it, but I think we should be open. But what if she likes him better? Or what if she likes his dick better? What do I do about that, right? Is it really that, is that the concern? No, okay. Can I carve out a rule that's not so intense as to saying we're in an open relationship, except you can't have sex with anybody else? What does that even mean? Can you just not tell me about his dick?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe that's enough. Right. And so you carve out the smallest rule to protect whatever vulnerable piece or, you know, exclusion you need, and giving the person maximum freedom, right? Like, can you, if you're going to watch porn, just please don't be in our bed. That's our whole, you know, that's our sacred place or whatever, you know, those kind of things. Have the discussions, even if you're the most monogamous, most traditional, whatever, have the discussions.
It's funny, because I do find that people are perhaps, whatever the word is, the most monogamous, most vanilla, all those things.
Yeah.
They're the ones that don't have discussions or rules. And people that might be nervous about things like, I don't know, BDSM and bondage, they don't realize how much negotiation and discussion and almost contracts are created when you're going to go into a BDSM scene, etc. Because they talk about things so much more openly. Yes, no, maybe, safe words, all that stuff. But we're just generally having this regular sex, whatever that looks like. We don't ever talk about it. So I think there's almost something erotic in talking about it beforehand and almost building up the anticipation of what might happen.
Absolutely, right? These things like the BDSM test, you know, you could trade them if you're gay men, certainly, but or in most cases. But if you're, you know, sexually progressive straight people, or you met on Field or something like that, you could trade it ahead of time and try to like figure out your dynamics a little bit.
Yeah.
I've seen, you know, yes, BDSM kinksters are so much more familiar with language and rules and facilitation and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. People think that this is a really, like, there's a lot of cruelty and meanness. With a lot of buy-in, with a lot of checking in, right? It's a much more, it's a safer space than undiscussed traditional sex, right? It's often much safer. And you see these like incredible intake sheets, right? Where it's like, oh, okay, how do you like to be touched? How hard? What part of your body, right?
When you're talking about, like, yes, you know, so on page 74,
many pages long of like, okay, what scents do you like? Mm-hmm. Do you like the smell of sandalwood? Do you like the smell of this kind of flower? Do you like this, like, holy mackerel, right? Like getting so into it. And these kind of things, they don't even have to be that kinky when we're talking about like, which scent of flower do you like? But that's something that a very traditional, very monogamous, very long-term kind of couple could use, that some of that knowledge to make things still interesting in year 23. And like, okay, the kids just moved out. Can we try to have sex again? How do we do that? Yeah. Right. But people are often not talking about it. I want more joy. A lot of, you know, a lot of my clients are coming to me looking for a loving partner, right? That's they might have, okay, they're almost all referrals. But occasionally somebody stumbles on my Instagram. It's Date Coach, by the way, dot.com, because you can't actually have a dot there. Or they just come to datecoach.com or something. And they find me and they're looking for, I want a loving partner. They have their goal in mind. But what about the journey towards that loving partner? What about their dating life until then? What should that look like? And then with the loving partner, things continue to evolve. So these tools of candor and communication are valuable just in and of themselves, whether we're, you know, whether we're still single or we're 10 years into our marriage, right? I find it's amazing how many, when I ask people, okay, well, what do you want in this relationship? And they say, good communication. Uh-huh. what does that even mean? What does that mean to you? Right. Yeah. Well, you know, they tell me, you know, we talk through things if it irks them, what, you know, how to, okay, absolutely. Do you already do that? Not always. Right. Everyone wants good communication, but it's almost always when people are sharing what they want, the first things they talk about are the things of past trauma for them. They had, you know, okay, what would you, in the perfect romantic world, what would your romantic life look like? Well, first, my partner would have no racial hangups. Ooh, okay. That means we've encountered, that's the very first thing we say. Then we've encountered some, you know, some racism in the past and exclusion. Very first thing, you know, there would be a lot of trust. Okay, that means our trust has been violated, right? That's almost always the first thing people leads with is the source of pain of the past.
Mm-hmm. Do you think things like ghosting and breadcrumbing, and I read about a new one to me today anyway, called Shrekking, which is intentionally going for somebody that you believe is less physically attractive than you, in the hope that they'll feel somehow almost grateful in a way. Do you think they've always been around, or are they part of the modern dating phenomenon?
I think the smartphone and the apps are new, right?
Yes.
Most of the dynamics are, you know, old as time. We also just didn't, we keep coming up with these terms and bounce about in the TikTokosphere and the, you know, whatever. And we come up with all these fun things, and people actually like to just come up with new terms just to get people to click. I'm like, ooh, what does that mean? I don't even know that term. Right. Mm-hmm. I don't think that relationships themselves are more dysfunctional just because of the apps in general. Right. Like, there's pros and cons, right. You know, one of the cons is when you look on an app, you can put in these filters, right? You can filter by height, you can filter by education level, you can filter, it depends on the app, right?
Yeah.
And the data shows that these filters, the things you can filter on, are given outsized importance, right? Mm-hmm. This is not what really matters in a relationship. And you can't filter on what does. Mm-hmm. You can't filter on how does he look at me? How does he talk to a server in a restaurant? My father has dementia. How much patience will this person have? Right. This kind of stuff. You can't filter on that. Right. And yet people do that. Oh, okay. Well, I really want somebody who has a master's degree. What? Right. There's all these geniuses out there who have bachelor's degrees or no degree or something. Like, yes, I understand it would be slightly more likely that they'll match your, you know, amazing intellectualism or something if they have that master's. But like, what a shame that's, you know, how we have to filter, right? And almost always, well, I have to filter something, otherwise there's too many guys. If you're doing it right, our messages shouldn't take that much time. We should be going on more dates in person, right? And you know, a lot of people are like, ah, the apps suck. Well, how many dates have you been on? Very few, because the apps suck. There's a lot of other people who are less attractive than you going on tons of dates. You've got to go on more dates. A third of people who call themselves like online daters, who's used the apps, a third have never been on a single date through them. Right? What does that mean? Right? You can't say that, like, well, Bumble and Hinge and Tinder or something are just like hopeless. Look at the, you know, New York Times wedding section and how many of the weddings started there. Like, they're not impossible.
Do you think people vary in this, I think. So they go on Tinder, they find somebody and they say, right, let's meet for coffee next week. And on Tuesday, I'm going to meet for coffee. And then maybe on Wednesday for dinner or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they have that. Do you think they should be doing that with a number of people at the same time? And then deciding after, I don't know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 dates. Okay, no, this is the exclusive one. This is where I'm going with this one.
I think they should.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
No, I think so as well. If you're doing a linear process, my goodness, it's exhausting.
It will just take so much longer, right? Because, you know, for most people, they want to go on a few dates with someone before they're even thinking about being exclusive with them, that they know them well enough to define the relationship, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, because of people's schedules and stuff, to get to that might take a month or it might take 6 weeks, or it might take some, you know, probably not a year, but that time, if you say, okay, as soon as I go on a first date with somebody, I go off the apps, I tell everybody I'm messaging, hey, I'm going to be busy for a little while, I'll get back to you later. And you only can have one person at a time. This process is likely to take longer, right? You know, as long as you're being relatively candid again, right? If the other person thinks that they're in an exclusive relationship with you, and you know they're assuming it, they just haven't said it, and you're dating other people, that's not good. That's duplicitous, right? But a person who goes on one date with somebody, it's unreasonable in modern society to think that we're exclusive without having had a conversation about it, right? So yes, continue on there. Every moment that we remove ourselves from the dating process is a huge loss, right? I work with my clients a lot. They're like, oh, I'm so sick of messages. I'm busy with work. I'm, you know, child care, elder care. I'm just not feeling well. I had a cold this week, so I didn't send any messages. Each time we get knocked off the horse, right? If we look at the end of the year and we like only spent 30 out of 365 days sending any messages, well, that's, you know, we're giving up 90% of our opportunity to meet somebody, right? So we come up with, you know, all kinds of fun techniques to like keep ourselves from getting knocked off our horse, and, you know, make those troughs of inactivity like not as profound and to zero and not last as long, right? But yeah, by all means, until you define the relationship, it is not a relationship.
You've been very generous with your time. Just a couple more questions, if that's okay. Well, one of which is, and you may have no desire for this whatsoever, but one of the huge strengths of what you do and the differentiating factor is you. There's only one of you, as far as I know, unless you figure out how to clone yourself. So do you have a vision that your next step is to train, guide, certify people as date coach associates? Do you have a desire to scale more? Because 24 hours in a day, you already work 23 of them. But or is it about how do you share the knowledge and the wonderful insight you've got with other people to be able to scale this more quickly or more broadly? Does that make sense?
It's a really thoughtful question. I appreciate it. The ambition is something that I resist. It doesn't lead me to happiness, I've found. And when I was a sad, closeted teenager, I started developing ambition, right? And it helped me stay in the closet. Was like, well, I can't, if I want to ultimately be, you know, an ambassador or some things like this, I have to, you know, really worry about my appearance that much and what people think of me. So prestige and ambition, I think, are ruinous for many people. I remember in college, probably 20% of people were writing their papers and living their life and making their decisions about what, you know, drugs and alcohol they would use based on like, well, what will the memoir about me? What will that, you know, what will the biography of me? What will it think about this? Oh my goodness, right? Live your life, enjoy yourself, right? So when I made the career switch, right at the beginning, you know, I had to just build up a client base. Once I had that, now I am fully employed and I don't have to worry about that anymore. And it's just client referrals and, you know, a little bit of Instagram and, you know, interviews with nice people like you. It's enough, right? So should I do more? So the more things I could do is, yes, write a book. I have all the material. I could just write a book. I could, you know, set up training courses. I could create, you know, datecoach.com. It's a wonderful website. I could, you know, turn that into, you know, a bunch of date coaches underneath me. And there's, you know, there's another dating coach I respect who she has chosen to do that and train other people. And that, could that do more good? Oof, maybe. So maybe I'm being selfish by saying it's not what I want. What I want is that joy of working with one person and seeing them fall in love, right? And I get to experience that with them. And, you know, if, you know, there's a little less money and I have to think, maybe my kids don't need the organic avocados, whatever, okay? That's, It's enough. And I get too much joy from this, right? Maybe, you know, it's only been 5 years, maybe 25 years from now, I'll be like, oh, I want to try something else. But for now, I'm resisting it. My clients are often asking, you know, can you do more, you know, newsletters? I'll lead a speed dating or a singles mingles or a dating workshop or a body confidence workshop and stuff. It's a little bit fun and it's a little, you know, it's a little different, but ultimately, my goodness, it's the coaching that is so exciting to me, right? And, you know, and for my clients, it's not, and, you know, thinking about, am I just helping one person? I'm at least helping two, them and their future partner. So it's at least two, right? I think it's enough. And when it starts to just turn into hubris and my old ways, if I allow myself to start empire building, when I just want love. That's what I want, Andrew. I just want people to have love.
I think I've done about 85 of these now, these podcasts. And I think that's probably my favorite ever answer.
Thank you.
No, that was a really, yeah. Yeah, that's very thoughtful and just a good. I'm not going to ask you any more questions now. That was a perfect. I can't think of, unless you're going to give a better answer for the next question. But no, I think that's perfect. That's yeah, and that's really wonderful. Thank you so much for doing what you do. I'm so glad you're in a happy relationship. I'm so glad you got to help so many of the people be in happy relationships. It is helping. I think love. It's almost sounds like a song, but love is so important. If there's more love in the world, I think we'd be in a much better place. You know that better than anybody. But thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Andrew. I appreciate you and what you're doing here too. Thanks.